Welcome to another edition of the Better Health Radio Show. And on deck this evening, as we had last weekend, we've got Dr. Adanna Grandison, and she's going to continue her discussion from last week. So without further ado, let's say a special good evening to Dr. Grandison and her guests.
Good evening, Gregson, to you and to the wider Barbadian public. And thanks once again for having us back on the Better Health Radio Show this evening. Now, last week went way too fast. We had lots of callers who were quite interested in the topic that we were discussing last week of benign prostatic hyperplasia, prostate cancer, and erectile dysfunction. And the time sort of went by really, really quickly. And Dr. Rouse really answered all of the questions that our listeners posed to him. And so we thought it best, I promised that we would have him back. And I said, why wait until later on in the year? Why not see if we can finish off this topic, get all those questions answered? And so this evening we have back Dr. Paul Rouse, who's joining us. He's a urologist here in Barbados. And just for those listeners out there who may not have listened to last week's show, just to give you a bit of background on Dr. Rouse, he was educated here in Barbados. He's an alum of Up and On. I will give in this week after being scolded last week by the troops. So he is a past alum. He's an alum, sorry, of the Commonwealth Secondary School, went on to the Barbados Community College, and then attended the University of the West Indies in Trinidad, St. Augustine, as well as Barbados. His postgraduate education involves him attending the University College of London, where he obtained a Master's of Science in Urology in 2007. Then he went on to do his DM in Urology in Trinidad in 2000 and earned it in 2012. He sat his intercollegiate exam in urology with the RCS UK in 2013 and passed, and became a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons in 2014. He's had experience both in Barbados and certainly within the UK, acted as a consultant urologist at Eastbourne District General Hospital, as well as a consultant urologist at the Royal Berkshire Hospital in the UK before returning to act as a urological surgeon here in Barbados. And he's located at 11th Avenue in Belleville at Rouse Urology Center. Dr. Rouse, welcome once again. You are no longer a stranger to this space, and I thank you so much for returning again this Sunday to really continue to educate the public of Barbados. Welcome.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Barbados. Thanks for having me again. Thank you for that very lovely introduction. Thank you again.
Yeah, so for our listeners out there, if you have any questions, we had quite a number of questions last week. Just wanted to remind you that the numbers that you can reach us at while we're on the show would be 434-1790. If you want to ask Dr. Rouse your questions directly, you can call him at 434-1970. Or for those of you who may be a little shy, you can also WhatsApp at 266-4862. Once again, that's 266-4862. So Dr. Rouse, when we finished off our session last week, our final note really was, we started to speak about erectile dysfunction. And I know this is a topic for some men, it makes them quite uncomfortable. So I want you to start off by really telling us, what is erectile dysfunction? Because I think even within that title, there is a lot of misconception. So can you enlighten the public about what erectile dysfunction is?
Well, yes, thanks very much. So we would kind of define erectile, not kind of, we will define erectile dysfunction as the persistent or sometimes recurring inability to get and or maintain an erection sufficient for satisfactory sexual performance. So it is a little broad in that sense, in terms of when you define it in those parameters, but it's all encompassing to a certain extent. Not only are there psychological factors that really bring to bear on as far as erectile dysfunction is concerned, but there are also definite organic or pathological factors that can lead to erectile dysfunction. Certainly, we would generally say, in terms of the organic, we either divide it into vascular, which is probably the more common cause, so problems affecting the blood supply to the penis, whether or not there's any neurologic injury or as far as the prostate is concerned, neurologic supply to the penis, or if there is any hormonal factors causing problems as far as penile function, erectile function is concerned. And then, as per usual, you can have combinations of all these factors playing a role. And certainly it do. Almost invariably, once you start to get the more commonly vasculogenic type of erectile dysfunction developing, more commonly with our STD, non-communicable DC NCDs here in Barbados, the high prevalence with diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, heart disease, these almost invariably lead to issues as far as erections are concerned. Then that plays on a man's psyche, and it almost sets off a vicious cycle where, unfortunately, as the organic disease gets worse, the psychological impact gets worse, and it sets off that sort of spiral downhill that we almost invariably try to break, with varying success. So that's probably a little introduction in terms of what erectile dysfunction is. And I should also mention here, as we did on the program last week, there's not only the man in the bedroom, there is his partner, in most cases his wife, who is affected by this and sometimes can have some issues. We kind of today we'll focus a lot more on the male side of things, but there are quite a lot of issues as far as female sexual dysfunction is concerned. But I think we better leave that for another program because that's a huge topic, not a very well researched topic actually, but we can look at that in another program in the future.
Yes. So I am going to pause here because we already have our first caller ready to ask a question. Gregston?
Yes, hi, good evening. God bless. How are you?
Good evening.
Yes, ma'am.
I am
All is
fine,
well?
thank you.
Oh,
Yes,
wonderful.
please. I'm fine,
That's
thank you. And you?
Thank you very much. Yes, God bless. Appreciate all my grace comes from you. I really wish that grace be over you, and please stay very gracious. Let me add some grace to the program. Let me thank you for being so bold, Dr. Grandison, in terms of leading out this discussion and to the good doctor, and thanks to Grayson for taking my call. And want to thank you about last week as well, answering my questions. Yes, so I have, so let me get into it. The first question, now you would note that the runner, Asafa Powell, had a lot of groin injuries because he sprints very quickly. He's known for the most sprints under 10 seconds in the 100-meter race. So I was wondering how does sprinting, constantly sprinting, affect men and affect those teens who are now getting into not having wet dreams and so on. How does it affect them in terms of the fact of their progression as men going forward to even the topic you just discussed? So thank you very much. The second question I have is that is based on the urological nurse. How important is he or she? And I did get the answer that you told me last week. It's not based on he or she. It's based on competence. So I just wanted to follow up on that. So if you can give me some follow up on that. And the other question, I had another question. The other question I had was based on bedwetting. Now, I, as a boy, used to wet my bed every night. And I didn't have to drink a lot of water. What are some of the things that you can do to help our boys and men in terms of bedwetting? Where you mentioned the herbs and supplements last week. Thanks for answering my question. But what are some of the things? If they're taking in water and so on, the days are hot and they're wetting their bed constantly, as I did. The final question that I have is based on the fact of stimulation. We will note that to get a proper one, you have to be stimulated. Now, I'm wondering if certain men, do you as a urologist, do you need specific stimulation to get it, or can you be anything can just make it up? In other words, is it a mind over muscle factor to the penis, or is it just the natural platonic to romantic attraction? Does any other attractions, animal, men, that kind of thing, does that play? Can that play? And thank you very much. Have a good evening. God bless, boy.
Thank you very much. So what I'll do is I'll start with the first question you asked, really, and I'll try to summarize as much as possible. Can running, sprinting specifically, have a long-term effect on a male as it relates to, in the future, that male developing erectile dysfunction?
From a sporting point of view, so I'm going to talk broadly. As far as I know, I do not believe sprinting specifically can affect your ability to your erectile function. However, I do believe with subject to correction, cyclists can correct me on this, but I do believe certainly competitive cycling. Back in the days when they used to have the gooseneck saddles, where you had a lot of pressure on the area in between the buttocks and the scrotum, where we call that the perineum, we had a lot of trauma to the perineum. Certainly, there was a higher incidence of erectile dysfunction in those men because it caused direct trauma to the pudendal artery, which is the main blood supply to the penis. I presume it probably still is probably a factor, but certainly the saddles have changed dramatically over the years in recognition of that issue. I must admit, I haven't looked at it recently because, quite frankly, we don't have too many professional cyclists here in Barbados. But I do, in terms of sporting sports, that certainly was one of the sports where it was well recognized that doing those long cycles with in those days when the saddles weren't so good, yes. But I don't think for the average sport, no, causing a direct injury. But if you get an injury in that area, clearly, obviously, you know, we need that part of our body for our sexual performance. If that's injured, then certainly our sexual performance will go down, but not directly in terms of disrupting the blood supply or the nerves, as, for example, with cycling. So that, I think that should answer that first question with cycling, with sporting. But I think one of the other things we must be cognizant of is use of steroids, anabolic steroids in sports. Yes. I think that's probably where you would see most of the erectile dysfunction. Mm-hmm. So that would come under the hormonal influence. So if you take anabolic steroids, you inhibit your natural production of testosterone, and in the long run, that can have certainly devastating consequences, not only your sexual function, but also your fertility and other issues, heart disease, etc. as well. So certainly, indirectly in terms of sporting, from abuse of steroids and or in terms of cycling, I think those are two areas I can think of offhand.
Thank you, Dr. Olson. I don't really know, and I don't think it's not corrected based upon your answer. I don't think that you also know the nature of the injury that the listener was actually talking about when he spoke about the injuries that Mr. Powell would have had. And certainly in order to give the most accurate answer, really understanding in great detail the nature of that injury would be necessary. So I can certainly agree with you. I have never heard about it, certainly. I've heard about cycling and certainly those more aggressive contact sports that sometimes you can have, very close contact sports, judo, that sort of stuff, where persons can get direct trauma to the actual groin, depending upon what they do, then yes, certainly they can have issues. The second question, I think we already answered that. And yes, I promise you, and Dr. Rouse and I, we worked quite hard. However, the second urologist, she's actually quite busy. And so she was unable to attend this evening. But she also gave me a promise that she would come and sit in with us some evening so that we can have a further discussion. But we did try to that listener who wanted to know the answer of female versus male urologists. But really, it boils down to competency. The third question that was posed was a question of bedwetting, if I'm not mistaken. I know that this is really not related to erectile dysfunction, but maybe, Dr. Rose, you could spend about 2 seconds really just explaining how bedwetting occurs, or why does bedwetting occur, not just in males, because it occurs also in females, especially, for many reasons.
Yes, so there are quite a few reasons that one could wet at night, a lot more common in children, and generally most people will grow out of it. I think it's probably somewhere in the region of about 5-10% of of children will still persist by the time they get into school. And by more or large, by the time they hit their 9-10, most children. This, we're not 100% sure. It could range from overactivity of the bladder, or to sometimes we think kids are just strong sleepers for whatever reason. And hence we can use various therapies, like in terms of, we can use alarms to help kids in terms of getting up, recognizing when they're wetting, get up and develop that mechanism more naturally, or aid in development of that natural reflex. But there are some pathological conditions, namely more common that we would see is the overactive bladder, and it can affect kids as well, as I said. And you would need some more specific therapies for that. So it's a little tricky to just go off on a tangent as far as that's concerned, because it is quite a broad topic. And I will admit, quite frankly, because I know I'm here in Barbados, I'm dealing a lot more with adults rather than pediatrics. I would really recommend in that case, we probably should get the pediatricians on to discuss this topic in more detail. I certainly will come in point of view with the overactive bladder and the treatments as far as that's concerned, but I think most of my pediatric colleagues manage that very well. I very rarely get a referral for that. It really would be if there's an anatomical problem where, for example, the sphincters don't develop very well. And again, since I'm not an expert in that area, I think most of my pediatric colleagues know to refer overseas, because that's quite a specialized area.
Yeah, and I have to agree with you here. This is a common area that most pediatricians deal with, certainly because there are a number of other reasons, from sleep disorders, stress, especially in those adolescent children. That's where we get really concerned, especially when we see that the child has been progressing quite nicely and then suddenly they recommence bedwetting. It can be something as sinister as abuse, a very soft marker for abuse. So when we see bedwetting, you should never take it as something that is very light in nature, and it should be investigated. And the first protocol for any pediatric case really should be to that pediatrician to make sure and have a very thorough investigation of the child. Gregson, I see you have a caller, but I'll pause that caller for one quick second so that Dr. Rose can answer the last question that the patient had. Is ED simply related, and I believe you started to really hint at it, is it simply related to physical stimulation, or is there a psychological component as well to ED?
Although in erectile vascular event, it really begins in the brain with arousal. So if you're not aroused sexually, if you're not attracted to your partner, then clearly, obviously, you wouldn't get those desires and those feelings to start the whole process off. So it actually starts with arousal in the brain, which then leads to the vascular event, which leads to an erection. Just quickly in a nutshell, so we can get in that caller.
Yes, please. Gregson?
Go right ahead, ma'am.
Good afternoon to you and the panel. Hello.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
My question to you is, right, I used to see my uncle take that box and put in his pants, before he go to play cricket, Suppose he had, if he forget to put it in, and that ball hit him, he will be in pain, would that affect his testicles and make him impotent at any time?
Okay, so I think that's a great question. So just let me summarize that and probably widen it a bit. Can direct trauma to the actual genital area of a male, whether it's hitting them in the penis or penis and testicles, can that result in impotence?
The average trauma, no. With a cricket ball, it wouldn't cause a immediate erectile dysfunction. So we would see it in what we call traditionally, as you alluded to earlier, Dr. Grandison, you have to, if you get severe pelvic trauma, it can disrupt the nerves in the pelvis, namely we call the cavernosal nerves going into the penis. So it's usually got to be quite violent trauma, usually associated with fracture of the pelvis, to really cause direct neurologic injury or vascular injury that would lead to erectile dysfunction. Generally, with a cricket ball injury, you're going to either, it's usually testicles that you're really worried about in terms of damage to the testicles, and that can cause bleeding, hematomas, and stuff like that. But you have to really cause tremendous damage to really disrupt the hormonal production of the testes. A lot of times, even though you might get a hematoma or injury to one testicle, you hardly get it to both. So you may get some minor injury, but usually not sufficient to disrupt it, your total hormone production. So it's quite safe, people, to continue to play cricket and play sport in general, because the risk of that, you know, having that tremendous severe trauma to the point where it's going to disrupt your pelvic nerves is you know, it's very rare. I don't know what you'd be playing in order to do that. You really see that in the setting of a motor vehicle accident. So play sports, it's safe, okay? Just use the correct protection.
So cricketers must always wear that guard.
I would.
Well, yes, they should. I mean, yeah, below to the testicles is one of the most painful things in the world. I would.
I think, or that ball and that ball hit you real serious.
Yeah, it hits you really serious. But although it might cause some damage to the testicle, usually it would recover. And you really have to lose both your testicles to lose your hormone function to the point where it could lead potentially to erectile dysfunction. So, I mean, I think that's very, very rare. Most of the time I would see it in the, or I've seen it in the past, because the UK system is quite different to here, where all these specialized injuries go to specialist centers. You will see it in the context of pelvic injuries, and they usually went out to special centers. Here in Barbados, I presume, obviously, we deal with it. Unfortunately, because I work primarily private, it would probably be best to ask one of the colleagues in the hospital setting to see how much pelvic trauma they see and the resulting incidence of erectile dysfunction following that. But that motor vehicle accident is a well-recognized for pelvic trauma leading to erectile dysfunction. But that, again, that's quite rare. So the average sporting injury, no, shouldn't really cause erectile dysfunction. Play sports, it is safe. Just make sure you use your guards and, you know, do all the safety, employ all the safety measures from cricket to hockey to football to basketball. You know, just be safe. Karate, you know, those are all very, you know, that we can get direct trauma to the perineum, to the scrotum, to the testicles. But by and large, it's quite safe, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you, ma'am. And yes, you don't want to get hit there. I tell you for a fact, it's not a pleasant experience. Doc, we've got another caller. Do you wish to engage?
Sure. No problem.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Let's go for it. Good evening.
A very good evening.
Good evening.
Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to ask, I didn't get the doctor's name, but however, I want to hear him talk about nitric oxide as it relates to, you know, the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1998, three American scientists won the Nobel Prize in medicine. So if he can speak to that, as it relates to endothelial dysfunction, which is, you know, to ED, as opposed to just erectile dysfunction, it's really endothelial dysfunction. So if you can speak to that, and I might have another follow-up question.
I think that's a great question, Dr. Rose. Yeah. You want to take that question?
Yeah, no, I was going to say this caller is very, very much informed. I love my patients to challenge me like this. So as I alluded to, an erection is really a vascular event. It's a nitrous oxide induced cyclic AMP mediated event where the nitrous oxide stimulates, you send me back to med school now, guanine cyclase that converts GTP to cyclic AMP, and then the cyclic AMP causes a decrease in your intracellular calcium, which leads to relaxation, which increases blood flow to the penis, and then leads to an erection.
My
colleague is quite right and very well informed. So yes, those scientists did get the Nobel Peace Prize because guess what? It led to one of the most well-recognized drugs in the world, namely Viagra or sildenafil, and those drugs inhibit the breakdown of cyclic GMP, and hence promote vascular increased blood flow in the penis, and hence maintaining or giving a better quality erection and hopefully a much longer lasting erection. So that's where the caller was alluding to. Not only is it produced by nitrous oxide produced by the cavernosal nerves, but as the caller alluded to as well, we do see there is also vascular nitrous oxide synthesis, which is important for endothelial dysfunction. And hence then he's leading on to, I presume he's going to go on to probably talk about again how the NCDs causes the endothelial dysfunction. So longstanding diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol all lead to endothelial dysfunction, which affects almost every organ in the body, every tissue in the body, from your brain to the tip of your toe, and hence causes erect endothelial dysfunction in the brain, leading to strokes, in the heart, leading to heart attacks, heart disease, ischemic heart disease, and by no means either, then in the penis, leading to erectile dysfunction. So that's where the nitrous oxide pathway or mechanism comes into play. I most invariably can anticipate his next question. Does arginine, which is one of the precursors for nitrous oxide, is that supplementation good for the penis and erectile dysfunction? I remember I looked at this recently because some patients have been using this, but I think objectively when you look at studies, no. But it is a food supplement and it's quite safe, I think, from the psychological sort of placebo effect that it does give patients. I think it's helpful. As far as I know, it's not dangerous in terms of supplementing, so I think it's quite safe to do that. Because I anticipate his next question is going to be about using arginine supplements to boost your nitrous oxide. Yeah.
The only thing that I would insert in there, however, Dr. Rouse, is a lot of the supplements are not regulated by the FDA.
Correct.
And because they're not held to the scrutiny of FDA in terms of how they are produced, sometimes you can get trace levels of heavy metals, etc. And this is something well studied within the forensic community because there's no regulation. And so patients need to be very, very careful, not just of the L-arginine, but certainly of taking supplements across the board, especially those that have not passed FDA regulation, because you want to ensure that what you're taking and what is on the bottle is actually what you're taking and not additional things. And I think that that's a really good question that the caller actually asked, because really that's where my conversation was going next. But I think the caller had another question, so I'm just going to listen up for that second question. And
just
then
quickly, just to reinforce that point that you just made though as well, is that yes, a lot of these herbal remedies are actually laced with sildenafil and tadalafil, Cialis and Viagra, in quantities that are not regulated. So it's very tricky because they are readily available. I'm not going to call any specific product because I don't want anybody to come and say I'm causing false claim to these products, but they are laced with these products, and I do warn men they need to be a little bit cautious when they're taking them from that point of view. You highlighted from your, because of your forensic background, the other not so nice things in terms of toxins, but from my point of view they are laced with the sildenafil and tadalafil. And that's why men think they're working very well, but really, actually, they're getting a drug, actually.
But
I'm not saying that they're not some natural remedies out there, but a lot of the over-the-counter ones are laced with the 5-alpha reductase inhibitors.
My supplemental question, if I may, is the two amino acids, L-arginine and L-citrulline, which makes... because the body generates nitric oxide naturally in our body, but it diminishes as we age. And this might speak to, the question that the first caller had about the legs, where the body is not pumping the blood back to the heart through the veins. So can you talk about that, nitric oxide? Actually, you did speak to nitric oxide. the process. So I will hang up and listen. Thanks. A good show. I hope to have you on. But you didn't indicate, I didn't hear your name. If you would be kind enough to let us know your name.
Dr. Paul Rouse. And,
good. Our featured doctor this evening is Dr. Paul Rouse. He's a urologist here in Barbados.
Thank you.
He was on last week. Sure, no problem. Dr. Rouse, you highlighted a very important point. And I think that this is something that many men tend to gloss over quite often. And that is the connection, as our two callers so far have alluded to, and that is the link between NCDs and ED. Now, quite often persons think, doc, if I take the medication for the diabetes or if I take the medication for the hypertension, it is not going to cause me to function how I usually function. And so, you know, I am really not about taking it, doc. This is a constant battle that sometimes many doctors have with males who are attempting to preserve their erectile function. However, I, as a GP, I know that this is a very dangerous game that they're playing, simply because we have even found that sometimes ED is the very first and soft marker of bigger cardiovascular disease and something that we really need to be focusing on. Can you dig a little deeper and really explain that link, if you could, very quickly, because a lot of men think it's the opposite way around. The medication causes the ED, but really it is the atherosclerosis or the endothelial dysfunction, as the listener said, that is actually causing the damage to the patient, and why men need to act early.
Yes, so it's very important. So let's take the two more common diseases, diabetes and hypertension, that most people, and then almost invariably they have a combination of both. The diabetes definitely causes the endothelial dysfunction. And the longer your diabetes remains out of control, the more damage you're going to do to your endothelium, not only in the penis, but throughout your body, and the more complications you're going to suffer. In terms of diabetes, is really important. Certainly, whenever my patients come to me with erectile dysfunction directly, if they haven't been treated GPs already, I must commend our GPs. They really do test patients for diabetes, hypertension, all those diseases first, make sure they're under control, and then they send the patients to me if they're still having problems. So those need to be ruled out right away. But more specifically, is really the antihypertensive drugs that are the real problem. As I said, an erection is a vascular event, is a vasodilation, and then that high pressure going into the penis that causes the penis to engorge. The outer coating of the penis, of the erectile tissue, the tunica vaginea, is rigid. It can't expand anymore, and that is the result why you get an erection. So it's like an increase in the pressure in the garden hose. When it's, you know, there's no pressure in the hose, it's very floppy. It's not, but as soon as you increase that pressure, it gets very stiff, it gets very rigid. A similar process happens to get an erection. And the problem with the antihypertensive is it disrupts that mechanism. So then the pressure head into the erectile tissue is not high anymore. And hence it can make the already problem they have even worse. And hence why a lot of men do not or are not compliant with the antihypertensive medication. I see it a lot more in that setting. And as you rightfully pointed out, Dr. Grandison, it is a dangerous game you're playing, because if your hypertension goes on untreated and you get a stroke and a heart attack, you're not going to be alive to be able to have sex. So I think you're really going to, not envy my AGP colleagues who have that difficult problem to deal with, because usually by the time they come to me, there is really a lot of problems already there. I can help out with prescribing the relevant medications, but it really starts with getting your NCDs under good control so you can maintain as much of your sexual function as possible.
And Dr. Rouse, before we go on to our next caller, because I see we have another caller, you stated it's the antihypertensive that we need to be concerned about, but is that true for all of the classes of antihypertensives? Because we know that beta blockers, for instance, can cause challenges for some men. However, it is really recommended that you don't just stop your medication. We often have to remind our men, please don't stop your medication for two reasons. Not just because you're trying to save and ensure that you maintain your erectile function, but certainly if you are on a beta blocker. So those are the drugs that end with lol. So your atenolol, your bisoprolol, those are the medications, that particular class of medication. You want to have the discussion with your doctor first, because if you're on that medication and you suddenly stop it, you can also cause what we say in medicine is a reflex tachycardia. And that in itself can be quite destructive if not managed properly. So it's a discussion to have with the doctor so that you are weaned off of your medication. Am I correct, Dr. Rose?
No, you're totally correct. I don't have to deal with that a lot because I think my GP colleagues manage that very well. I deal a lot more with the actual treatment of the erectile dysfunction. So I do think the GPs are really very clued on as far as this is concerned and try to manage patients. And it's really, I do see the complex issues coming through because when they come to clinic and their pressure is really high, and then I say, well, what's going on with your hypertension? I then try to get them back out to the GPs to get that managed. I'm not going to pretend I'm really good at managing diabetes and hypertension. Yeah.
Okay.
I do agree with you.
Gregson, we have another caller.
Hello, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yes, please. Go right ahead. I can hear you now, please.
Thank you. Hi. Good evening to one and all. I'm really enjoying the program. I'd like to pose one question, please.
Evening. Thank you. Sure.
Go ahead. There are some females who purchase and use, I describe them as enormous dildos for sexual stimulation and so on. I'm wondering, is there any potential that can be harmful to the female genitals? And is it true that it can actually create a kind of, I don't know, insensitivity when such females attempt to have intercourse, well, with males who mightn't quite measure up to the dimensions of the dildos? I'll hang up and listen to your response, please. Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Rose, I am not sure that this particular episode of the show, given the fact that we're actually dealing with ED, if Dr. Rose really wants to tackle that question, because I think it's more appropriately answered probably in another show, which Dr. Rose said he would be happy, and for female sexual dysfunction. I think that in the interest of trying to address all of our listeners' questions, you can answer. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I first thing, because women use these sexual toys doesn't mean that their vaginas are going to become loose. Okay. Vagina is an organ, it's a muscle, it can contract. That's how women get an orgasm, quite frankly. So a lot of times, a lot of men have this hang up that, oh, my penis is too small, I'm not going to satisfy my partner. Can I enhance it in some fashion? For women, and I'm hoping we in future we discuss this and hope we get our gynae colleagues involved as well, it is a lot more psychological. The physical part is very important as well. But for a woman, their orgasm, they will get constriction of not only the vagina, but other organs. And so the size of the man does not necessarily impact on that to a certain extent. So what I'm trying to say is just because a lady may use these tools does not mean that it's going to affect her sensitivity with her male partner. I would prefer to deal with that in the female sexual dysfunction arena rather than trying to explain that all here in terms of what female orgasm is all about. Just to say that, no, using these toys should not really impact. I think it enhances it because a lady learns more about her body, learns about what stimulates her, what gets her orgasm, and then she can have that discussion with her partner about how best to stimulate her, how best to get her orgasm. I find it's a lot more rewarding, or I get better results in terms of managing erectile dysfunction when men attend clinic with their partners. And I try to encourage it as much as possible, because as I said, it's not only you in the room, it's your partners in the room as well. And it's a two-way street. And her pleasure comes from knowing that she is pleasing you and vice versa. So it's really a conversation to have with the man and his partner rather than a man alone. I find I get a better response in that way.
Okay, Dr. Rose, before we go on to our next caller, another cause, organic cause of ED certainly is the heavy use of alcohol and tobacco. And I know here in Barbados, we do tend to struggle a lot with the heavy use of both of these toxins, certainly as coping mechanisms, especially for the alcohol, quite often. And I need to say this, I'm not bashing any person out there who consistently uses alcohol. What I would say, I can tell you from a medical standpoint, it is not the optimal thing to do to ensure you have good health. But I think it is important that if you do have a challenge with alcohol consumption, it is the perfect time. Now is always a good as a start as 2 weeks ago to have that conversation with your doctor. But quite often we see, for instance, guys standing in gas stations and there are 50 bottles. I will not call the brand of alcohol, but 50 alcohol bottles lined off on the actual side of the wall where, you know, guys are talking about, man, I finish off of my five and you got five more to go. Or you're going to half of the bars on weekends and you're seeing the table is littered with alcohol bottles. How much of an impact is this having on males? It might not be affecting them right away, but how does this affect the male long term?
So the short term and why a lot of men use it, and let's face it, we know when we're younger and stuff like that, we have alcohol and we know what it does. It loosens up your sexual inhibitions. And from a sexual point of view, it is a vasodilator. So it does seem to aid erections in the short term, but the long term uses are very well informed. Caller earlier in the program alluded to, it leads to endothelial dysfunction in the long term. It leads to damage to the endothelium, to the vasculature throughout your body again as well. And then adding on top of that, the toxins from cigarette smoke. Alcohol in moderation is safe, but as far as I know, there are no safe levels for cigarette smoking. And the toxins then in cigarette smoking, a lot of times you consume both together, then your alcohol has a permissive effect. It then makes the effect of those toxins even worse. So alcohol and then smoking, a double whammy. And in short term, you get the vasodilation, you feel good, you lose your sexual inhibitions, you're feeling a lot better. But in the long term, it's the damage that it causes to your vasculature, especially your arteries, medium-sized and smaller arteries, that ultimately will lead to erectile dysfunction. So in the long term, not good for you, especially cigarette smoking. I can understand alcohol consumption in moderation has been shown to be safe and good, but certainly, as far as I know, I've not seen any study anywhere saying that cigarette smoking is good.
Good. Gregson, and I'm going to go back to that drinking in moderation because, you know, you may say, well, Doc, you said I could only have one drink, but you decide to have the biggest glass in the kitchen. So remember, when we say moderation, for males, we tend to think 1 to 2 standard drinks in a day. So that would be 1 beer, 1 4-ounce shot of hard liquor, 1 glass of wine, and not the big, extremely large margarita cup either of alcohol to say, oh, I only had 1 glass, but a standard drink of alcohol, whereas females are allowed 1 standard drink per day. Actually, most recent studies, and I'm sure the cardiologist will probably say this, is that any amount of alcohol, they actually try to shy away from because of the cardiovascular effect, especially on the heart muscle. But Gregson, let's go on to the next caller.
Yeah, caller, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
All right, stand by 30 more seconds. Why? Because I'm not sure if this one will fit into our discussion, but the good doctors will tell me because I'm not familiar with this term. It says, good afternoon, doctor. I suffer from, it looks like, LBS syndrome. Can you tell me why it's so painful, especially in the tummy? Is that down our discussion this evening? Yes, that's what it says. LBS syndrome. LBS. I'm not familiar with that, but I'm not a doctor.
Is it LBS or IBS syndrome, well, as in irritable bowel syndrome?
Well, it looks like an L, but let's assume that
you... To message you back, mm-hmm, and lend some clarification to exactly what they're asking about. And this is a challenge that physicians have across the board, because there are many different acronyms that we use for many different things. So we just want to make sure that we are answering that caller's question, the person that typed into you with the correct stuff. So we'll just wait and hold a bit on that question until we get a bit of clarification.
Okay, so,
and we'll take the caller.
Okay, so you can message me back and you can correct me if it's LBS or IBS, as the good doctor says, and then she'll address your query, okay? That's to the WhatsApper who wants that into us. Caller, it's all yours, please.
Yeah, good evening, Dr. Grandison, and to your guest.
Good evening.
Yeah. Dr. Ross, good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Grandison, you talk about alcohol and it can affect your sexual functions, but alcohol can also can do severe damage to your liver, to the point where it can even kill you. So that would be a good
absolutely
point.
Absolutely. I agree with you.
That's
and most importantly, your heart.
Yes. That's mm-hmm a good point to mention. Anyway, don't I have a kind of a jovial question for you, though? I talk about Dr. Rouse, though. I once heard a lawyer telling another lawyer if he has to go to court, he should not go by himself, because the worst client a lawyer could have is himself. I've heard that on the floor of Parliament already. So the question for you, Dr. Rose, is this. If a urologist developed the issues that he's treating people for, can he treat himself, or he needs to go to another urologist?
No, I would recommend any doctor, when you get unwell, to go and see your doctor. A doctor should have a doctor. The real reason being is, and I've been in this position myself on several occasions, is that you can misdiagnose yourself. There's a real principle in medicine in that we do not treat our relatives. I would not treat my sister, I would not treat my brother, I would not treat my mother, any close person, a close friend, any close friends I have, I refer over, even though they might not be blood relatives, because your judgment gets clouded by your emotions. And that's a principle that we have to adhere by. I mean, I could be personal. I can remember I've treated my sinuses. I suffered chronic sinusitis, especially when I was in the cold countries. And I was treating myself with antibiotics. And guess what? The bugs that were up in my sinuses was resistant to the antibiotics. And I'm taking antibiotics 2-3 days and getting worse. I'm wondering why I wasn't getting better. Am I all stressed out? And went to my GP. They did the relevant swab, did the relevant test, realized that the antibiotic was almost not appropriate. You know, I could have easily damaged myself, led to multi-resistant bugs in my system. And then I'm in a hospital setting, potentially passing on those multi-resistant bugs to potentially resist vulnerable people, immunocompromised people. So I would recommend any of my fellow medical colleagues and nurses, for that matter as well, go and see your doctor. Don't treat yourself. You run the risk of potentially causing some serious injury to yourself, okay?
And in addition to that, Doc, at this part of the program is a little bit sporty. In your exuberance to treat one of your family or one of your very good friends, you might over-treat them, or like you just said, give them the wrong thing in your exuberance to get them well.
Yeah.
So
that's why I said,
I want other than,
you know, yeah, correct. I always refer. So when all my close friends, I refer to, when they have urological issues, I refer to one of my other colleagues. I do not treat them. I mean, obviously, if it's a dire emergency, I would treat someone. You know, that's our oath. But, you know, for the most part, erectile dysfunction is not urgent that you need to be treated immediately. So I would refer them over to another colleague. And I respectfully ask them to see another colleague. You know, don't put me in that position in the first place. And they understand. Once you explain that, most colleagues will understand. Yeah. Most friends will understand.
It might sound like a sporty topic, but it's a very serious one.
And
yeah, no, that's why I said you can injure yourself treating yourself. So we do recognize that. And, you know, I gave my little personal experience as far as that's concerned. And I think what we don't do is go get treatment in the first place. We think, oh, it will pass, you know. I think that is one of the biggest problems with medical professionals, in that they resist going to the doctors in the first place. But as the good old-fashioned saying, a stitch in time saves nine. So get there first.
Yeah. Thanks, Doc.
You're most welcome.
Great. Thank you.
All right, Doc. Before you continue, the WhatsApper heard our plea and they sent in the correction. It says, hi, Greg. It is IBS, Irritable Bowel Syndrome.
So there you go. Great, please. As I thought. Dr. Rose, you want to take that question? So reread the question now that we have.
I suffer from IBS. Can you tell me why it's so painful in the tummy?
Well, Dr. Granison, this might be more of your street. From a sexual point of view, because the bowel and everything is near the bladder and things like that, almost invariably people with irritable bowel syndrome also sometimes have overactive bladder syndromes and chronic pelvic pain disorders, and therefore sexual intercourse can be very painful for them. So I think that's where you would see the sexual dysfunction coming into play, especially on the part of the female. It is very uncomfortable having sex if you're having chronic pelvic pain.
Yes, and also in terms of IBS, when we usually think about IBS, there's a significant inflammatory response, and down within the pelvis is a very small space. So persons will tend to have, once their IBS is they're having a flare, where they're having these tummy cramps, and sometimes they get bloating and lots of gas, and sometimes it really depends too on the type of IBS that they're having. Some persons, and this is not really the show for this, but some persons very quickly can have a combination of either being constipated or having diarrhea or both. But once you're having that flare, certainly it will cause some discomfort to the abdomen, and some persons can also have some of the other organs being affected in the area. And this is not just unique to IBS. We see this same or similar pattern happening with things like endometriosis. Once you're looking at any of those inflammatory conditions, especially for the females, they can complain of having pain during the pelvis, sometimes pain radiating to the back, sometimes pain defecating, pain having sexual intercourse, just pain in the pelvis in general. So it is something that can occur, and it's usually because of the inflammatory response that persons are having.
One WhatsApper is here saying they have both irritable bladder syndrome as well as irritable bowel syndrome.
Yes, that's what I was alluding to. That's where I would see it in combination. A lot of times when they have irritable bowel, they almost have overactive bladder syndrome as well. So if you're going to pee frequently, urgently, getting up several times at night, it almost invariably leads to sexual dysfunction as well. You're not going to be interested in sex if you need to pee every 5 seconds, or you're worried about wetting while having sex. So that's how I see it in that setting. So it's really important for my GP colleagues or the gastroenterology colleagues to get those conditions under better control. So then you can, once you're not in pain from those conditions, not worried about it, then you can then participate in sexual activity.
Great. So Dr. Rose, we spoke about some of the major physical reasons why a person can have ED, but we all know, as you stated, it starts all in the mind. And sometimes persons who are either very stressed, depressed, anxious, or having any other mental health condition, or something as simple but as deadly as poor communication in the bedroom or poor communication within a relationship, can sometimes cause lots of damage to the psyche of a male. Would you like to talk a little bit about that in terms of what should men do? What help should they seek? Because there are lots of persons who sometimes, especially for the mental health conditions, can certainly suffer in silence. Any advice on that?
As I alluded to earlier, I really like to, when I do recognize men are coming to clinic with erectile dysfunction, I really do like for them to come with their partners. A lot of men, a lot of times they don't. And it's for that psychological component, psychogenic component of the erectile dysfunction, because it's not only just the physical lack of blood supply to the penis, but as I said, it all starts in the mind. And that counseling does take a lot of time. I won't lie to you, I don't have a lot of time in clinic to really go into it, but we do have psychosexual counselors here in Barbados. I know one person in particular, it's very difficult to get patients out to him, because when you start talking about going to see someone, people are starting to think that you think that they're mad. So it can be a little bit tricky to convince them to do something like that. And there are also other counselors, certainly when I was at GRB, I do, when patients do need some help in part of that, I do refer them over for that assessment, once they want to have that one-to-one communication with a psychologist, not a psychiatrist. I want to reiterate that they're not mad. It's a psychologist who can discuss the issues with you and your partner and hopefully delve into where the problems are and get a better control. I will admit it's very difficult in a busy clinic to really delve into those psychological issues. But once men are willing and their partners are willing, I can make those referrals over to the relevant parties.
And I should remind our listeners out there, developing depression or anxiety or any other psychiatric diagnosis is something that can happen to anyone. It's not the bad luck of your draw. It's not because you decided to go partying 2 weeks ago and this is payback from the powers that be or the gods if you're a really spiritual person. It can happen to anyone. And so it is not something that should be stigmatized. I often recommend that patients almost see it like hypertension. You can see the physical manifestations at times because of hypertension or diabetes. We warn our patients, for instance, make sure that you keep your feet covered so you don't get infections in the feet because you stand on a nail and you can't appreciate it, and then you have to get an amputation. Whereas mental health conditions are illnesses of the mind. And so we just want to encourage patients not to feel that they need to suffer in silence. They should definitely go out, get the help that they need, because it can make the world of difference in terms of their daily life and being very, very functional. Dr. Rouse, wanted to go ahead and ask a question in terms of what are some of the treatment options, just very broadly, and what is your approach to a male when you see that he comes into the office and he says, hey, doc, you know, this urinal has been going on for a few months. I really don't know what's happening, but this is really starting to bother me. What is your approach?
Yeah, so as you alluded to, and most of my GP colleagues do all the basic workup in terms of making sure no diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, heart disease is all under control, then we can start looking at drug therapies. As we alluded to earlier there with the Cialis and the Viagra or tadalafil and sildenafil, the phosphodiesterase inhibitors have come to the floor now, as our caller alluded to about those three men that got the Nobel Peace Prize for identifying the nitrous oxide pathway as the mainstay of the initial management of erectile dysfunction. So we'll start with the 5-phosphodiesterase inhibitors. We usually start at a low dose and then work our way up to the maximum for sildenafil from 25 to 100 milligrams, and the tadalafil, the two more common here in Barbados, 50 to 20 milligrams. If the medical therapy doesn't, the phosphodiesterases don't work, I do have available now, with the aid of one of my pharmacy colleagues, I've been able to get the intracarbonosal injections, certainly Cabrajet. Desperately still trying to get the Trimix. So Cabrajet is where we inject the intracarbonosal therapy. A lot of men hate it. They don't like the idea of it. Injections directly into the penis, but it's actually a very effective form of managing erectile dysfunction. And then, quite frankly, if directly injecting medication into the penis doesn't work, then the last resort really would be considering a penile implant, whether it be a malleable or a three-piece inflatable. got very little experience as far as this is concerned. I do believe some of my colleagues may have some experience as far as that's concerned in terms of inserting inflatables. But intra-regionally, I'm happy to report that we do have a urologist in Trinidad who has specialized in this form of treatment. And I do try to refer my patients to her. It's a female urologist. To look at having penile implants. And obviously, if you don't want to stay regionally, you can refer you to North America. I didn't quite mention the vacuum erection devices because they're not readily available here in Barbados, but that's another form of therapy that is available. We use a special device to create a vacuum in the penis to increase the blood supply, and then they apply usually a constricting band, a rubber band, to the base of the penis to maintain that erection. So there are quite a few different therapies available, options available that I will sit and discuss with my patients and hopefully with their partners so that it can become part and parcel of their sex life. Because as I keep reiterating, it's not only the man there with his partner.
Okay, Dr. Granderson, you may have to just bring the good doctor back again if you have time for that, because the phone is still going. We've still got some queries on WhatsApp to read, but we're out of time. And I promised this gentleman who called in, who did not want to stay on the line, he wanted me to take the question down from him and pose to the good doctor. I promised him I would do that. So just this last query, and then we have to say goodbye. So you might want to invite the good doctor again, but that all depends on your schedule. This question to you, good doctor, Dr. Rose, the gentleman says, what causes enlarged testicles? That's number one. And how safe is the surgery to correct this?
All right, so again, that's a little bit broad, but quickly, I'll be concerned whether or not there's a direct tumor of the testicles. I'm not sure how old the gentleman is, so please see your GP in the first instance, get that assessment. I think most GPs are well clued on that anytime we're concerned about testicular tumor, we need an urgent ultrasound scan. If it's a tumor, a mass of the testes, you need an urgent referral to the urologist. Testicular cancer is one of the most rapidly progressing type of cancers, but actually one of the most readily, easily treated and have a five-year life expectancy well over 90% once it's treated properly. That's a direct testicular tumor. A lot of the times, quite frankly, though, it's usually a cyst or fluid around the testicles. So what we call a hydrocele, when it's the sac that encloses the testicles becomes filled with fluid, or when the epididymis can develop cysts that can mimic a hydrocele. So if it's just fluid, that's usually not as urgent, but it's good to get the diagnosis, get the ultrasound early, see what's going on, and make the appropriate referral as need be. So quickly, in a nutshell, that's what I would recommend. Getting that urgent review by your GP, at least in the first instance, or call one of the urologist's office directly. You know, we know this, and I usually would have a quick chat with one of the ultrasound centers and get an urgent ultrasound.
Well, I want to say thank you so much, Dr. Rose. I just wanted to give these very practical take-home points for our listeners based upon what you would have said. You want to make sure and manage those NCDs. I know that we quite often think that they are things that we should not take very seriously, but it can even affect our sexual function. So make sure and manage those NCDs, I'm making the same error as Dr. Rose. We want to make sure that we try to address the modifiable risk factors out there, which we didn't have any time to talk about. So we want to make sure that we're eating properly, we're actually exercising to make sure that our cardiovascular health is significantly improved. Make sure you're drinking your water, you're sleeping. Try to reduce those stressors out there and get as quickly to the doctor if you're having this issue, and start the discussion with your doctor. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. There's nothing to be ashamed about. Just go there and get the help that you need. And Dr. Rose, I want to say thank you so much. These sessions are going way too quickly. And I think that we probably need to plan a session at some later date with Dr. Bellamy, where we can continue to speak about some of these issues, these very burning issues that persons have, our listeners in community have, and try to address some of these misconceptions that we may have in community as well. So I want to say thank you so much. And thank you, Gregson.
It was a pleasure.
All right. Thank you kindly to both of you. Dr. Adana Grandison, your host this evening for the Better Health Radio Show. And continuing from last weekend, we had Dr. Paul Rouse again. And I'm quite sure he'll be willing to come back again as long as he's afforded the invitation for our next discussion re this topic. So thank you kindly both. Sorry we got to run away from you, but we've got another program coming up next. So until next weekend, Dr. Grandison and Dr. Rouse, have a wonderful work week ahead. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.